Hello everyone, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformations. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated and replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I am Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm the former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric, and my expertise lies at the intersection of economic trends with technology and innovation. I am joined today by Misha Doller. Misha is vice president of emerging technologies at Ericsson in Silicon Valley, focusing on 5G, 6G, AR, and generative artificial intelligence. He serves on advisory boards for Ofcom and the FCC, and is a fellow of several prestigious engineering and arts societies. A serial entrepreneur, Doller has found five companies, and he is a composer with five albums to his record, to his name. Previously a professor at King's College London, his work has been featured by CNN, BBC, The Financial Times, and others. And today we're going to start off our discussion on a concept that is front and center of Misha's work, which I find fascinating, which is the Internet of Skills. Misha, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. Over to you.
Oh, pleasure being here with you. Thanks for having me on your podcast today. Yeah, let's dive straight into that. The Internet of Skills. It is a baby of mine, which I started at when I was at King's College in London 10 years ago. So it kind of struck me that we do have an internet which allows us to read emails and to browse the web and watch maybe videos. But there was no internet which would allow us to actually execute work, labor, skills through a digital means. And I thought if we had a construct like that, it would probably democratize labor exactly, sorry, it would democratize skills and labor exactly the same way as we have the internet democratize information and knowledge to some degree. And the kind of the spiritual, the inspirational approach to this came at the height of the Ebola crisis. We had doctors from King's College London down in Africa, and they were reporting that they were lacking skills because other doctors were afraid of flying down there and get infected. And they told me it would have been great if we just had the ability to administer some vaccinations, to take temperature, or even a human being, just being with a human being. And this is what kind of gave me that inspiration to that Internet of Skills. Let's build an internet which allows me to democratize my skills, whatever that is, whether that is haptic, kinesthetic, whether that is I teach somebody how to paint, or I teach somebody how to play the piano, or I do remote surgery, or I do an engine maintenance. So loads of different applications we thought of back then, but we started from a blank canvas. So we started design 10 years ago, and today we're in a very different space. But I just wanted to give you a little bit of background where this came from.
That is a fantastic way to start. And it's a fascinating and extremely powerful concept, especially now, because you know, I look at these issues from the perspective of an economist. We're in an era where there's a lot of innovation, and you are front and center of innovation. There is also a productivity crisis. Productivity growth has been languishing at low rates for quite a while. And it's always seemed to me that one of the keys to getting productivity to accelerate is exactly the upgrading of skills, which are becoming more and more the scarce resources. Now, in the examples you've just given us, Misha, it strikes me there are two dimensions to this Internet of Skills. And tell me that is the interpretation is correct. One is the ability, so democratizing, widening the opportunity for people to acquire skills. So I'm sitting somewhere in Africa, I don't know how to do something, I need help to figure out how to do it. The other one is the access or the broader reach of people who already have specific skills. And I think telesurgery probably falls into the second bucket. What is a useful way to think about these two dimensions?
Yeah, so I'm with you on this. So one is really the teleproctoring, right? The ability to teach somebody remotely or co-intervene. And this could, for example, be the piano case, right? So if you record the way how I play the piano or Yang Lang actually play the piano, you build a skills database. We probably can standardize that. And then whenever anybody wants to learn how to do that, they would download that software package onto some exoskeleton capability or device, which essentially is teaching me how to move the fingers exactly how Misha moves the fingers or Lang does, right? So you would learn exactly the way how we play it. And that is for the proctoring, helping with your muscle memory, helping you to learn new skills, repair an engine as an example, something fairly complicated. You don't really want to learn that as a mechanic over 5 years. You just want to really tackle a very specific problem you have. So it's a bit like the Matrix movie, right? Where you download your skills and you actually execute that. And yes, we can do that today, interestingly, right? And then the second bucket, which you mentioned, is really about the tele-intervention. And this is for more intricate, more complicated interventions. Medical, you're absolutely right, is one of these. But I'm also thinking of artistic things, right? So once you get really to the top notch of artistry, this is not anymore just being able to karaoke a song. This is really Chris from Coldplay or Rob from Massive Attack doing something really on top of their profession. How can you get this teleskill somewhere else? How can you get the top-notch engineer of Boeing repair something in space of Tesla or SpaceX, etc.? So this is more on the second bucket. So I think there's a long-tail model that taking your economist lingo, right? So long-tail model on the first bucket on the teleproctoring, and there's a very narrow but high-value bucket for very high-end skills.
That is superb. But let's dive into the telesurgery for now, which is in a very powerful application and one that potentially can do an enormous amount of good. So tell us, Misha, what is telesurgery? How does it work? And what has been done so far?
So again, I got the inspiration when I worked at King's College 10 years ago with my surgeons on the problem. So King's has 4 hospitals, so it kind of was a natural fit for us to work on that. And they told me, look, Misha, our problem is that we do have a large catchment area in the United Kingdom. So patients from all over the UK, particularly the Southeast, come into King's, and when they get into the Iron Hospital, it is often too late. And that is because in the urban and suburban areas, the medical skill may not be at the same level as in the urban centers. And it's not because they're worse. It's just they don't see so many cases. It's a question of volume and velocity. So I thought it would be great if we could televise that skill and kind of have a much earlier intervention. And this whole idea of 5G-enabled telesurgery came about. Now, it turns out that I was not the first one. Actually, that whole concept of telemedical intervention, specific telesurgery, had been born maybe 10 years by Jacques Mariscot, who was just before September 11th, conducted the very first telesurgery from France to New York. It is now known as the Lindbergh operation. And 10 years earlier, we had Fred Moll bring actually robotic surgery equipment to market. invented. And 10 years earlier to that, a guy called Rick invented the whole notion of robotic surgery. So we had like 40 years of inventions happening every 10 years to make it happen. Now, where are we today? So I moved now to Silicon Valley in the United States. US is a big market. It's a very federated market. So very difficult to bring, let's say, a medical solution nationwide to market. But I'm currently working with the best surgeons in the country. I'm working with representatives of the FDA. We founded an FDA collaborative community. I'm working with networking companies, robotic companies, all the medical societies. And the idea is really to tackle what would be a very important United States use case. And that is stroke and heart attack and brain stroke are two very big use cases. About 500,000 people are affected in the US every single year. Out of these 500,000 people, only 10% are lucky and they don't even notice something has happened to them. Another 10% are lucky because they are within driving distance to a hospital which can deal with that. And I remind you, you only have about 30 minutes to 4 hours to do something, depending on your age. If you're young, it's more or less. If you're a bit older, you have a bit more time. So it's a very stringent time window. And the remaining 80% of the population are not lucky at all. They either die or they remain disabled for the rest of their life. So it's a huge cost to families, to society, and also a huge cost to the healthcare system. So we started to work. I started to work specifically with endovascular surgeons. My good friend Ryan in Michigan is one of the pioneers. He's been deploying remote surgery in that for quite a while already, and we already bring this to production. And then I have on the laparoscopic side, Vipul Patel, pioneering a lot of that. He sits in Orlando in Florida. And the idea is really now to make that work. We're building first prototypes. We want to build networks which are very reliable. You need to make sure that during the operation, if one of the networks goes in outage, the other network can take over, which is why we need fiber, we need 5G, we may need another 5G, we may need satellite. So we're building a cocktail of networks to make sure the operation is safe. So that is the current state of affairs as of Q3 2024.
And you're already hinting at the kind of infrastructure and equipment which is needed, right? You've highlighted the importance of the communication infrastructure, which clearly is crucial. What about robotics and medical robotics infrastructure? So is the idea that because there is a relatively limited number of hospitals with the right surgeons to do these operations, that we would have a wider distribution of robotic equipment so that if I am somewhere in the middle of nowhere, I'm somewhere in rural Alabama or wherever, and something happens to me, I can be taken to a local hospital which has the right equipment that can be operated remotely. Is that how it works?
Exactly. So you always have two ends of the robotic surgical device. So you have the actual robot where the patient is. It is doing the interventions. And then you've got the control side where the surgeon is. Now, we had that for quite a few years. Intuitive Surgical has pioneered that. And what we're doing now is we need robotic surgery companies to decouple that, right? So to make sure that the surgeon and the patient can be in two very different locations, not just about 1 to 2 meters apart from each other. And since the operating surgeon looks into a console anyway, it doesn't matter where the patient is per se, right? It just matters that the connection between surgeon and patient is very reliable and very stable. And that if something does go wrong, there's enough medical skills on the patient side to intervene and at least stabilize the condition, right? So, and we can do that today. So we're working now with robotic surgery companies to do that. And interestingly, the big boys of the industry, they may have less interest in actually bringing such solutions to market because they're selling already really well the very integrated robotic surgery solution. So it's up to startups. And we're getting now really good and cheap solutions. I give you a specific example. So Ryan Mutter, who is really one of the best surgeons in the United States on anything endovascular, so heart and brain, neurovascular, and he has been operating on a mock flow model this was not on a real patient, but he just wanted to show it's possible. He was sitting in a restaurant or in a coffee shop with a little game controller, because in the endovascular stuff is in and out and talk. So he was doing this from a game controller in a coffee shop. He was sitting in his car. So you can imagine a future where we have put in every single hospital outlet, whether it is high-end or low-end, a very cheap endovascular robotic device which can receive patients that are being put down. Then we do a make a call on a platform to available endovascular surgeons. Ryan happens to be available, but hey, he's having dinner with his family, so he may just step out for a moment, take his mobile phone, do the operation, or help and supervise the operations being conducted, comes back into his family dinner, and continues essentially with his life. So I'm exaggerating the situation. I just want to show you how powerful that democratization could be in the future.
That's fascinating. And I have at least three follow-up questions on this. One is the following. As you pointed out, with this telesurgery where the surgeon is operating, looking at a screen in front of a console, it doesn't matter where the patient is. Can the patient be up in space?
A great question. The patient can be up in space. And I think it is a very pertinent question you're asking on this specific blog here. And NASA is actually very interested in deploying solutions like this. So there's a company run by a good friend called Dimitri. He's built a virtual incision. He's one of their lead surgeons, chief surgeons. And the idea is to have a very simple, this case, laparoscopic. So it's not endovascular. It's a laparoscopic one with a little insertion hole. Single arm. It's deployed in space. In fact, they just flew that up. Summer 2024, it was brought to the space station and they conducted a mock operation up there from the ground. And it is important because what I think NASA and probably SpaceX and others will be very worried about is if there's a medical intervention required, which really is needed, where you need really high-end medical skill, then the people on board can't really operate that. So can't really conduct that operation. So doing that remotely from Earth and widening the type of medical interventions, I think, is very powerful. So the community is doing that. It's a very urgent emergent use case. And I think, frankly speaking, a quite exciting one.
It really is. And much like the rest of the Internet of Skills you were describing, it's something that I think will be crucial to push forward the space economy, which is one of our favorite subjects in this podcast. Second question I had for you, Misha, on this is you've mentioned the FDA. So for something like this, how important is your cooperation and collaboration with the regulators, and how does that unfold?
It's a great question. So the FDA as a regulator is actually very open to collaborative engagements. Of course, for their internal decision processes, they have rigid mechanisms, which the external world is not invited to. But what I think they do really well is they engage with the ecosystem early on so they don't get surprised with new capabilities. And I think what the entire medical device industry is going through at the moment is we are currently in stage one, where we conduct operations where the patient and the surgeon are in the same room. Stage two will be where we separate them. They're in different geographic locations. So suddenly the network becomes a new regulatory unknown. And stage three will be AI in the loop, which will either conduct the operations autonomously or will be supervised by a human in the loop. And then the AI and the network are suddenly in the loop. Now, the FDA has something called the collaborative communities, and we just founded one. You can look it up, Anina. We just founded one on the telesurgery and actually also on AI. And we have regular calls. These are tech people like me. These are surgeons, some of the best surgeons in the world, frankly speaking, attend these calls, and representatives of the FDA to learn of each other's advances, questions, worries, challenges, and opportunities. And so we're doing this, and specifically in the networking side, the FDA is, of course, not regulating the network per se, but they're regulating the devices. So they're regulating the endpoints, and they want to have peace of mind that devices can operate even when there is a network failure. So they need to know that the device manufacturers has thought about all possible networking fluctuations, latency changes, jitters, outages, changes of networking characteristics, that this can be tolerated by the device without jeopardizing the patient's safety.
That's excellent. Misha, the third curiosity I had about this, and this will become relevant as we move forward, and this unfolds from, as you mentioned, stage one to stage two, which is really more remote surgery becoming more widespread. The way you describe it, this allows, Eric, let me take one step back. You've set the stage by giving us some fairly shocking numbers on the number of people who, even just in the US, have a cardiac event and are not close enough to a clinical center that can help them. Now, with telesurgery unfolding, they will be reachable by the right skills, which means that the potential demand for the existing surgery skills will increase significantly. As we get to that stage, and again, I understand we have time to plan for it, but as we get towards that stage, are we going to have a buffer zone where the existing number of surgeons have enough spare time on their hands, so to speak, that they can treat more patients with this technology? Do we need to rush the pipeline of creating a larger number of surgeons? How do we square this circle?
That's an excellent question. In fact, it's one of the questions which has really preoccupied me quite a lot, because we're not really solving a problem for my friend Vipul Patel in Florida or Ryan Mata in Michigan if we now make their already busy day a nightmare because they have to be on and operating 24/7. So this is what surgeons told me. They told me, look, Misha, there's a real gradient of skills across the country. And again, this is not because the surgeons in the rural areas are worse from a capability point of view. It's a question of density and velocity of the cases which come in for that specific intervention. So with the telesurgery kicking in, the role of Ryan and Vip would be initially, of course, to conduct these surgeries. But then for this surgeons and the rural hospitals would be present in all interventions. They have to be present because if something goes wrong, they probably need to intervene to continue the operation one way or another. So to make sure that the patient is safe, etc. And so over time, as this happens once, twice, three, four times, they're picking up on the tricks and tips of Ryan, who's an OVIP, well, like top-notch surgeons. So therefore, the idea is to lower that skills gap to the point where they do not need to call in anymore the high-end skills unless there's something really hairy going on that then they require essential lot of help. So the secondary benefit is that we are equalizing the skills capabilities of surgeons in the United States. And that would allow then Ryan maybe to also focus on entirely new techniques, on new ways of conducting surgery, having more time to experiment with new stuff on his plate, such as AI-enabled surgery, etc. So that is a future, how we envisage that. I'm not sure it answers your question, but this is how we think about it at the moment.
No, it does go a long way towards addressing my question. And actually, it makes me wonder if we can connect it to the skills building strategies you were discussing earlier. Earlier, you were giving the example of how one can be taught matrix-like to play the piano like Misha. And since I am completely, let's just say that music is not my strong suit. So the idea that something might teach me to play the piano like you is very exciting. Now, the way you were describing it, it's not truly matrix in the sense that it's not an intervention that goes directly to my brain, but it's haptic, right? So I would have an exoskeleton which guides my finger to play the way you do. And so I would build muscle memory. And it will go from my muscles to my brain. And that's how I would build the skills. Bringing back to telesurgery, is it applicable there as well? Can you imagine having the same essentially guiding a, say, less experienced surgeon through the recorded skills of a top surgeon as a way of improving their abilities?
Yeah. So the, I think we will see that, even though if you look at surgeons, when they already do surgery, they have been 10 years for the program. So it's as if you have been playing the piano for 10 years. It's just that you haven't practiced for ELISA as often as another pianist has, right? So therefore, I think the applicability will be less in for the, literally for the memory, muscle memory training. And by the way, it's a different part of the brain which takes care of that. It is will be more for the aspiring students. So one thing which the medical profession has at the moment is they really struggle to teach medical students on how to do a suturing, how to do cutting, how to do certain very haptic and kinesthetic interventions in the human body. So imagine now the ability to not only train the students with some exoskeleton and some haptic feedback, but also test them, because currently the testing is done on paper, right? So it's a very old-fashioned way of doing it, how we've been doing it for the last 4,000 years. And suddenly you have a way of doing a three-dimensional testing. In fact, a way to test your skills, how we interpret the world, because we don't live in a 2D world. We really live in a 3D world. So I think there are a lot of opportunities, and specifically in the early days of the careers.
That's exceptional. It's exceptionally interesting. Misha, what are the, we focus a lot on the healthcare application in telesurgery, which is, again, extremely inspiring and powerful. What other main applications do you foresee coming online? Are you talking about the Internet of Skills more broadly?
So I worked on quite a lot with the transport industries as well. So in the 10 years ago with the likes of Heathrow, Transport for London, TfL. And the question was, could we actually remote execute quite a lot of skills which you have at the moment? And 10 years later, it turns out that if you look at some ports around, let's say harbors, so water ports around the world, they're already using that Internet of Skills capability to control cars, enter trucks, to load and unload containers. So we are seeing now the emergence of people-less ports, where the safety of every single individual is guaranteed and the skills is being executed remotely. We are seeing this now also in car manufacturing capabilities, where people are starting using modern tools like NVIDIA's Groot program. That is a program where you can teach a robot from humans to do certain tasks. So as an example, you can teach it how to cook, which isn't that obvious, because as a chef, you would need to pick up, let's say, a raw egg, and any robot, you haven't really told them how to do it, which is prescient. And therefore, teaching that properly by mimicking essentially human behavior, learning from humans and emulating that in a digital twin world is very powerful. So we're seeing this now entering actually the industry world, soon the enterprise world, and I wouldn't be surprised if we would have that soon in the consumer world as well. Now, that was kind of the second bubble. The third bubble I'm very passionate about for obvious reasons is all around arts and performing arts specifically. And I was supposed to become a pianist. I kept composing. I've done loads of performances myself, released my fifth album in Los Angeles, where I played in front of 4,000 people. I have my older daughter. She's a musician. She sang with Madonna on two albums. So we're kind of a very artistic family, actually. How I ended up in a tech job, don't ask me, but here I am. Anyway, so I worked in specifically in London with really like big musicians. Rob from Massive Attack is an example. I worked with the National Theatre, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. And we posed a very simple question as, could we use this new Internet of Skills capability underpinned by very low latency, high performance 5G to kind of bring together this very innovative world of engineering into this very creative world of the arts, right? And if you think about it, there's a very strict line between both. So if you just think about theater has been very innovative, maybe 2,000, 4,000 years ago when we invented the stage, how it is, how we have it today. But nobody has done any innovation on this at all anymore, right? We're still the same stage, same curtain, same people, same seats. But over the last 4,000 years, we have put a lot of creativity in this, okay? And engineers arguably are very creative. So I thought, you know what, let's bring these together. It was a little bit like an atomic super reaction. First day, nobody understood each other. My engineers didn't speak the artist lingo didn't speak engineering lingo. So we did a lot of trust exercises, and day two was phenomenal. So we came up in the end with an entirely new construct on how we could utilize a three-stage production in the theater, the Young Vic, which is an outlet of the National Theater. And we would have a real, on each stage, real actors and virtual actors, real audience, virtual audience, connected with very low latency 5G. And we tried to get Shakespeare's Midsummer's Night Dream on this, and it was a disaster. And I thought, what is happening here? And then I realized the creative piece, Midsummer's Night Dream, was written for the innovation of a traditional stage. So we had to completely rethink the proposition, and we hired a screenwriter, a playwriter, sorry, who was really specialized in coming up with new ideas. And she wrote in a really amazing piece, very creative, for this new innovation of a three-stage virtual production, a hybrid physical virtual production. And it was phenomenal. It was about an adoption of a child, how the mother was that was the first stage. She was signing the contract of adoption. Second stage, she was regretting it. Third stage is she got the child back. And the theme between all three was the pen, which she used to write that, sign that initial contract. So it was a very emotional thing to this. I played with space and time. And just me talking about this, I get very emotional about this. So I'm going to stop here, Marco. Sorry, you got me going this. I'm just very passionate.
No, and hey, definitely don't want to see you in tears. Luckily, we're not on video, so the audience wouldn't see it. But I'm curious because it's your passion comes through, but it's very difficult for somebody like me who has not experienced it to visualize it. So what happens if I'm an actor in this production? I'm sitting on one of three stages, but at the same time in my performance, I'm interacting with both digital and actual actors who are in a different physical location, two different stages. And similarly, if I'm in the audience in one stage, I can see what is happening in the others. Tell me a bit more.
So it's a great question. So you could argue, why don't we just put up Zoom or Teams or whatever and make that happen? The answer to all of it, whether that is theater, whether that is music, whether that is you do anything else with the internet of skills, is building emotional bonds. And for that, you need to understand the physiology of a human being. So we have been hardwired to build emotional bonds to anything which happens within 10 to 20 milliseconds of interaction. And it turns out that the nerves and in the human body are very slow. So between the time I'm touching a hot oven and I'm realizing it's hot, often quite a significant time passes. I'm not talking about minutes or seconds, but I'm talking about 100 milliseconds. In fact, it's 120 milliseconds. And you see that when people don't know it's hot, they touch it, and only after just really a little time they get off. So, and that's the reason the eyes are attached straight to the brain. Otherwise, we would have in a more protective way somewhere else, maybe on the hand, whatever, because that's the shortest distance to the brain. So we have 10 milliseconds directly into the human cortex, and we are processing that. So when I'm with you in the room, we are building up an emotional response, which is very different to us talking across the Atlantic right now, right? And that is where 5G comes in. With 5G, we're building these very low latency experiences. Get it below 20 milliseconds, you're building an emotional response. So suddenly, all visuals, all audio, what you experience is as if you are with a person in the room, and suddenly it is as if you are right in the theater. You're right on stage with Chris and Copley. You're right in with Billie Eilish. You're right in the football game. And that is the magic. So you're building these emotional responses. And everything else is then kind of how you actually embody that, how you build the arts plays, etc. I could spend hours talking about this, but the crux to all this is that below 20 millisecond emotional response.
Fantastic. I'll make one comment because it to me seems very interesting. It's the following. The point you made when you said that the first example, the first production you tried was a version of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, and that it was a catastrophe. You pointed out that it's because it was not written, it was not designed with these technical capabilities in mind. And you mentioned the fact that engineers and artists don't speak the same language, but clearly they influence each other, right? Because clearly the existing technical capabilities in some way constrain and influence the artistic creativity of the person who knows that the piece of art, the symphony, the theater piece has to be produced. So what you're talking about opens up the possibility of a new evolution of art, right? Because opening different possibilities will, in a sense, free the mind, much like generative design is helping on the design side. It will help create new kinds of art, which I think is truly, truly fascinating. So we have a lot to look forward to. Misha, you get very passionate. I get very excited. There is a lot here which is exciting. Anything we should be concerned about?
Well, of course, having AI in the mix, and you have just alluded to that, there are quite a few regulatory constraints we need to take into account. Overall, democratizing skills, of course, will invoke a shift in the workforce in one way or another. And we need to make sure that we get a fair and equitable access to these capabilities into underdeveloped areas of this world, not only across the planet in Africa, South America, Southeast Asia, but also in unserved areas of the United States. So this is not only a second world problem, this is also a first world problem per se. So we need to make sure we make that very equitable. And I've been on that quest from day one. I really want to make sure that the cost of ownership comes down significantly, and you will appreciate that, Marco, as an economist. And one way of doing that, and in fact, I think probably the only way to ensure that, is to create standards. So from day one, I have created a haptic standard. Think of it like an MP4 for touch, because I wanted to make sure there's no lock-in. So I didn't want to have, let's say, a General Electric bringing up an Internet of Skills device, which doesn't work with a Siemens device, or the other way around, right? So therefore, building standards so we can enjoy these devices across capabilities, like we can record audio on one device and listen it on any other, will bring down costs. So I've created these standards, and they're currently being implemented globally. So therefore, making this very equitable, I think, is very interesting and very important. Bringing in the right regulations so this will not be abused. Particularly, I'm very worried for military usage, etc., which I really do not want this to be used at all. So I really want this to be a platform for the good of society, for the good of humanity.
And see, you're a very positive guy, which is exactly the attitude you need to have. So you've addressed the concerns, but you've brought us back to how we can address these concerns and how these concerns are being already addressed. Misha, this has been a fantastic conversation. Before I leave you, is there anything that we have not touched upon that you think the audience should know?
I think the intersection of generative AI plus these execution capabilities like the Internet of Skills, plus accelerator fabrics like quantum on neuromorphic, etc., I think is really forming a new, interesting, very fluid, very dynamic very imagined and probably not very predictable construct, which has the potential to bring us as a human race to entirely new heights, or has the potential to replace us as a human race on top of the food chain. So I think these are very interesting discussions we will have over the next years. And I thought we will have them at the end of the decade. And I wrote a policy paper about this with Cambridge University when I was still at King's College. But with the emergence of transformers, with the emergence of new quantum fabrics and new robotic capabilities, I think we'll have these discussions much earlier. So that is something which keeps me up at night, because I'm really sometimes a little bit scared about this, but also very excited about it.
Excellent. And I could not agree more. Misha, thank you so much. Congratulations for everything that you have done and are doing. And I think our conversation has given a very convincing proof that the Internet of Skills will be a defining feature of our lives for decades to come, and starting already now. So thank you so much for being with us, Misha. And
thanks Mark, for having me here. And great questions. And I hope I shed a little bit more light on how we tick, how we work, and what excites me in that really emerging world.
Plenty of light, blinding light at times. And we hope to be able to reconnect with you in a few months or in a year or so and see what else is new, Misha. And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and new business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry, what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to access podcasts, and you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thanks, everybody.